How many times have you heard this reproach of homosexuality? God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Well, in Paul Rudnick's latest play, the most fabulous story ever told, it's Adam and Steve who find themselves in the Garden of Eden. Screenwriter and playwright Paul Rudnick has satirized life from a gay point of view in Jeffrey and In and Out. He also wrote the screenplay for Adam's Family Values and writes a satirical film criticism column in Premiere magazine under the pen name Libby Gelman Waxner. The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told is now running off-Broadway. I asked Rudnick if he ever came up with a witty retort in response to someone saying that God didn't make Adam and Steve.
Well, I came up with a play. I thought, why not take these people at their hard-hearted words, sort of spin it, and see what would happen if God had indeed made Adam and Steve and the first two lesbians, Jane and Mabel, as well, to really take that as the basis for an entire New Testament. And it ended up being a wonderful amount of fun.
What are some of the differences between the two couples?
The two couples, well, it's funny. I think they go through, it's more a question of similarities, I think. I think the couples go through what, I wanted it to keep it as universal as possible, because they go through what every couple, gay and straight, go through. At one point, they're all captive on the Ark, where it's pouring, and they're surrounded by animals, and they've all been together for 400 years. So, of course, they pretty much have run out of things to say. And I think that happens to almost every couple. Sometimes it doesn't take 400 years, but suddenly they're, while still desperately in love, also at each other's throats. They're going through all those stages of romantic development. That's something else I wanted to investigate in the play, is to use the whole story of the Old Testament also as a romantic journey.
Of course, at least one of the people is having sex with animals on the Ark.
Yes, well, that's one of the interesting developments when you begin in a gay-run universe, is that people don't tend to reproduce quite as rapidly. So we remain, the planet has just those initial two couples for quite a few millennia. So the only romantic options after a certain point are all the rhinoceri and cats and pigs on the Ark. And because it's a very open and loving universe, it becomes kind of a great mixer.
Have you gotten any protests from religious groups to your script?
Well, it's funny, not quite so many. There have been a few. There's a group that is very dedicated to a defense of Our Lady of Fatima and whatever miracle occurred at Fatima. And so they, for a while, did kind of bombard the New York Theater Workshop with phone messages and letters, mostly asking, why couldn't Paul Rudnick write a play about Our Lady of Fatima? And I kept thinking, do they really want me to? You know, I thought it was an interesting question on both sides. But what I would hope is that anyone who worries about the play, who imagines objections, would actually go to see it. What I found most disturbing about a lot of the furor that surrounded Terrence McNally's play, Corpus Christi, was that erupted from sources that had no real contact with the play. They had neither seen it nor read a script. And I think you only get a more intelligent and human dialogue about any work of art when both sides have witnessed it, have gone through it, have read it or seen it.
The Pharaoh has a nice part in your play. And would you do for us a couple of the lines in which he's talking about the building of the pyramids?
Well, the Pharaoh is a role that I wrote for just a superb actor named Peter Bartlett, who's appeared in other of my plays and films. So I will only be able to do the most tepid impression of his genius. But he does play an extremely madcap and empowered Pharaoh. And at one point, he looks out into the audience where he envisions his empire, and he says, I have enslaved hundreds of thousands of homosexuals to build my pyramids. Oh, look at them all just sitting there, criticizing. Why can't we build a beach house? Get to work! No, he's that kind of pharaoh.
And then, how about the line where he's telling all the slaves to sing as they work?
Oh, yes, after there's been a kind of Spartacus-like slave uprising led by Adam, the pharaoh turns to one of his beloved Amazon guards, Fatatatita, and says, let them go. Let them all go. I am the boy king of all Egypt. I am immortal. Sing, gay slaves. Sing as you toil. Sing a gay slave song. And Phtahtatita says, sing to your pharaoh. And then the song that the gay slaves pipe right back is from one from chorus line, which I think is the equivalent of some sort of gay work hand gospel.
That's great. Did you go back and watch the Ten Commandments to get a sense of Hollywood biblical speak?
Yes, well, it had been pretty much ingrained that I grew up on all that sort of pop culture Bible. And that was also where the idea for the play came from, that sense of, oh, the Prince of, you know, the new DreamWorks Prince of Egypt, the DeMille films about the Ten Commandments and the life of Christ, that whole homogenized, weirdly American version of the Bible in which everyone speaks English. And usually the bad guys, the pharaohs, tend to have some sort of foreign accents, usually British. But the good guys, Charlton Heston, are always Americans and always seem like quarterbacks or chess club presidents. So it's a very strange and parochial view of the history of faith, but that's why it was also very funny.
Now, the way you describe the pharaoh in your play, you say the atmosphere might suggest Egypt by way of the MGM Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas. The pharaoh wears a striped headdress and flowing robes reminiscent of the blindingly golden attire of Tutankhamun. You know, I'm thinking a lot of those gay epics, they seem so... did I say gay epics? A lot of those biblical epics seem so gay in retrospect, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no inspiration for a drag queen like, you know, a decent pharaoh. I mean, those guys knew how to dress. I think they had the eye makeup, you know? I think everyone from Ramses to Cleopatra, they seemed distinctly Ziegfeld to me.
Did you have a sense of that when you were young watching the biblical epics, that there seemed to be just something gay about the movies?
Oh, I think so, or at least something wildly and welcomely absurd, which isn't the same thing as gay, but it's certainly a friendly neighbor. There certainly was something very homoerotic about that whole set of Hercules and Gladiator.
That's
and
the word
Ten
I was looking for.
Films.
Yes, that's right.
Oh yeah, that's where you get you know, Yul Brynner in shirtless in a tight tennis skirt, you know, with a few golden armbands around his rather impressive biceps. So there's a famous scene from
Spartacus.
Spartacus, yes, where I believe Tony Curtis is bathing Laurence Olivier, and the dialogue is fairly coded, but it's an extremely homoerotic scene. So I think, my God, those cultures certainly were enormously open to all sorts of sexual possibilities.
Did you grow up with any Bible stories?
Let me think. I grew up in a violently Reform Jewish home. So what I had were odd forms of biblical kitsch. I had a wristwatch that had a map of Israel on it, and instead of numerals, it had Hebrew letters. I also had a book that I really cherished that was made up of invented biblical headlines. It was printed on newsprint, and it said things like, David slays giant, read all about it. So it was the Bible translated into Gotham City terms, pretty much. Within my family, we were too Jewish to have a Christmas tree, but we were not quite Jewish enough to really celebrate every night of Hanukkah or to go over the Bible in any great detail. I remember at our yearly Passover seders, sometimes there'd be an uncle who would really want to go through the whole story in Hebrew and recite every possible plague, and the rest of us would sit at the other end of the table, you know, asking, when do we eat? And tossing our yarmulkes around. So it wasn't really a particularly devout home.
Now tell me what you do when you're in the audience and you're trying to monitor the audience's reaction. Do you actually count laughs or count the amount of time that elapses between laughs?
Oh, I'm far cheaper than that. No, I have this, it's this one of my deepest neuroses, is I somehow imagine that the audience's response is directly attached to my central nervous system. So unless I stay incredibly tense, they will stop laughing. I also tend to make very baroque deals with God, where I say if you allow the audience to laugh at the next line, you could take my right hand. And then if they laugh, I immediately rescind the bargain and move on to another body part. So hopefully by the end of each evening, I've just been reduced to, you know, a helpless torso. So lately I've been trying, this can get a little stressful. So I've been trying to relax. And what I found is that now I can really enjoy the play. Because I take such delight in this production, which was directed by Chris Ashley, who's directed almost all my work, and this cast, that I adore them.
Your latest play, The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, takes up the premise, what if God made Adam and Steve instead of Adam and Eve? I'm wondering if you've ended up thinking very seriously about religion as well over the past few years. I guess what I'm really asking here is I know that you've had a lot of, or I assume that you've had a lot of friends who've died of AIDS over the years, and that's the kind of thing that provokes a lot of people to examine or re-examine their thoughts about the role of religion in their life or any approach to spirituality. Some people find themselves drifting closer to it. Other people further away because they're so angry. For some people, they could find meaning through secular pursuits and don't feel the need to turn toward religion. And if you don't mind a serious question here, I'm wondering if the last few years have changed at all your sense of the need or not for religion in your life.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this play. I wanted to force myself to examine those issues quite seriously. And it's something that goes beyond even the questions of gay or straight or the comedy of the play, that I wanted to see why God is still such a provocative flashpoint for all of us, and to see what I thought, what I ultimately made of matters of faith. So it's been a real, oh my God, a continuing exploration. And it's funny, it's why often people now come up to me and say, Paul, do you believe in God? And it still could be a very uncomfortable question. It's why, it was one of the reasons why I wrote the play. I thought, you know, sexual matters have become so commonplace that in many ways religion and God have become this final taboo. And I wanted to explore that. And I think for personal conclusions, the most I've come up with, at least at this point, is I find genuine transcendence and a sense of the spiritual in my work in the theater, especially, and in film as well, but mostly in that intense collaboration with other people leading to, hopefully, God willing, the delight of an audience, that sense of a group creating something larger than themselves, of a communal good. And I think that also was mirrored in my experience with so many friends who've been sick and who died from AIDS, and working with people in the gay community and the friends of that community in New York especially. The truest religion seems to be the faith that you invent or accumulate on your own, and that can certainly involve enormous pieces or even entire manuscripts from traditional religions, but it's got to come from you or from me. It's got to be a decision that I come to, a morality that I can accept and try to adhere to. That's what makes the most bedrock sense, and that's something I can live with day to day. Somehow, if I'm always referring to someone else's text, to someone's Bible, to someone's Quran, then I feel like, my God, I've just been given a manual and I'm not quite sure if it's all going to work. But if I can go into a theater and see people of such enormous talent and such enormous generosity and work with them and then, you know, present something to the rest of the world and make them laugh, that's almost all the God I need.
Now, how do you deal with the fact that when you're actually at the theater, you're there making bargains with God, like you were saying earlier, that if they laugh at this line, God, you could take my right hand?
Well, that
I mean, old habits die hard, huh?
That's what I would refer to as insanity, which is my other personal gospel. Yes. Oh, no. When you want to laugh, all bets are off. I'm sorry. Human sacrifice would be an easy price to pay for a decent chuckle. You know, I have no problem with that. If the Muslims will laugh at me, I will, you know, head out after Salman Rushdie. You know, I think laughter it can also be a little bit amoral. There's that real, oh my God, deep inner laugh lust, and that pretty much conquers everything.
Paul Rudnick, his play The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told is now running off-Broadway. This is Fresh Air.